and rattled them like a beggar crow settling his feathers back into place. He flapped them once, slowly, and again, and then the third time he drove them down with a force that sent snow whisking away from him and wind whistling through the rents in them. Suddenly he leaned into his wings, his muscled hind legs driving him forward and up. He lifted from the ice heavily like an awkward seabird, but once his claws left the ground, it was as if he were released from its bonds. He rose steadily. I caught a glimpse of Risk circling high above us and wondered how she must feel to see such an immense being rising toward her. Tintaglia, apparently deciding that Icefire was now safely away from the awkward stone dragon, abruptly released her grip on Rawbred. She leapt, light as a lizard, into the air. Her silvery blue wings spread gracefully wide, and in two beats of them she began to climb toward the sky. Belatedly, Rawbred seemed to realize the attack on him had ceased. He threw back his head, roaring his hatred at us, then craned his neck to turn a mud-colored eye towards the sky. His neck was shorter and thicker than that of the true dragons. A rolling, vicious rumble came from his throat. The pale woman skilling to him carried the force of fury. I was not the target of her thought, and I felt but the brush of its passage, yet had no problem discerning the message. Her power of skill seemed less than it had been, as if the freeing of the dragon had exhausted her. She forced her thoughts through a quagmire of pain.
"Kill the dragons! One of them, or both of them, but kill at least one! Never mind the humans, they cannot harm you. Later you can devour them at your will, but for now, take your revenge on the 6 duchies. Kill their dragons, Rawbred."
And in that instant he turned his heavy head and snapped at Tintaglia's tail, closing his rocky jaws on its lashing tip. It jerked her from the grace of flight into a wild fall. She cried out, and I saw Icefire tip his wings and felt his gaze sweep over the struggle on the ground. He tilted and then dived sharply. The stone dragon had finally mastered how to spread his wings, and he sought at first to break Tintaglia's flight. But in that awkward effort, some vague idea of how to use them seemed to come to him. Never relinquishing his hold on Tintaglia's tail, he beat his wings savagely, making abortive lunges into the air. The struggling queen dragon was jerked about like a kite on a string. She screamed, shrill as a sword being drawn, and suddenly coiled back to attack her attacker. It was a mistake. For all her size, she was a butterfly battering herself against a lizard. The wind of her wildly fluttering wings sprayed icy snow into my face and drove me down, but did not impress Rawbred at all. He buffeted her with his heavy wings, slamming blows that sounded heavy slaps, like a slaughterhouse hammer, against her flesh. He would kill her. An instant later, the consequence of that thought came to me. The pale woman would still have won. Despite all, she would have put an end to dragons in the world. And no man could stop it from happening now. If Tintaglia's claws had not even scored the stone dragon's flesh, what could any weapon of ours do against him? A lifetime had passed in a heartbeat. I became aware of the prince standing frozen beside me, and cursed my foolishness. I shook him and bellowed, "Get out of here! There's nothing we can do! Run!" And still he stood and gaped, transfixed by the battle before us. Then Icefire struck, a bolt of black lightning. The force of that immense body striking the stone dragon shook the earth like one of Chade's explosions. Dutiful and I were flung to the earth. When I managed to get to my knees and clear my eyes, Tintaglia was clear of the battle. She crawled away from it, wings and feet dragging her across the snowy ground. Where her thick blood fell on the snow, it smoked. My wit sensed the waves of pain that flowed from her. I do not think she had ever felt such agony. The outrage and horror of it stunned her. Impossibly, the two battling males rose, clawing and flapping from the pit of tumbled ice. The battering force of their wing beats drove the prince and me to our knees over and over again as we stumbled and fought to get clear of their combat. I dragged Dutiful back, shouting, "If a stone dragon overshadows you for long, he can forge you. We must flee." Then the force of the wind from their wings lessened. Dutiful stumbled as I thrust him away from me, but I halted and looked back. And up. Locked in battle, yet still they rose, wings beating almost in unison. It appeared a strange and twisting dance they performed, claws seeking grips, and their heads repeatedly striking like darting snakes. But it was the strength of Icefire's battered wings that bore them up, more than the stone dragon's efforts. Clenched together, they rose, screaming, until they were black silhouettes in the blue sky.
"Fitz, look!"
Dutiful's shout was a whisper to my damaged, ringing ears, but I could not ignore the way he shook me. The idiot had come back. He was pointing down into the pit full of collapsed ice. There was a small opening at one end of it where the sliding ice had not quite filled the palatial chamber beneath it. A small gap remained open. Coming up that tumbled and shifting slope of ice was Eliania. She gripped a shrieking, struggling girl by the chains about her wrist and dragged her behind her as she determinedly ploughed her way up towards us. The girl's hair was matted to her head with filth, and a ragged shift barely covered her. But for all that, the family resemblance was strong. Eliania had captured her sister. Peyotta was behind her, half crawling as he emerged from the hole. A drawn and bloody sword was in his hand, and he towed a limp and emaciated woman behind him. Blood from a scalp wound sheeted one side of his face. As soon as he could stand, he seized the woman and tried to race up the slope, but the treacherous chunks of ice shifted and slid under his feet. He gained a span or two, and then went down on one knee. He was breathing in gasps as if he were nearly at the end of his strength. As we watched, he suddenly dropped his sister to the ground and turned to face his pursuers as they emerged on their hands and knees from the hole. Oeta Blackwater fell limply, unconscious or dead, and began to slide back down toward the gap. Eliania had reached us. She glanced back and shrieked as she saw Peyotta brought to bay.
"Hold this!"
she commanded Dutiful, and flung the chain at him. He caught it by reflex, gaping at his disheveled intended. Blood had run from one of her nostrils, outlining that side of her mouth in a caked line, and her wild hair hung loose around her face. Then she spun from him, short sword in her hand, and charged back toward Peyotta. Dutiful was left gripping the forged girl's chain.
"Hold this!"
Dutiful suddenly echoed her, and flung the chain at me. It fell to the earth before I could catch it, but I stepped forward to trap it under my foot before she could flee. But she didn't wish to flee. Instead, she flung herself at me, mouth gaping wide. To my wit, she wasn't there. But as I caught her and tried to fend off her attack, my flesh felt the impact of her blows. I have fought many men, but never had I reckoned on dealing with an emaciated 10-year-old girl with absolutely no fears or concerns for her own survival. Teeth and nails and knees, she sought determinedly to rip or pound my flesh from my bones, and made some fair headway at doing so, clawing my face and sinking her teeth into my wrist before I managed to fling her down in the snow. I covered her with my body, pressing her to the ice until I could roll her onto her belly. I reached under her and seized her elbows and then jerked her back against me so that her arms were crossed on her own chest. She continued to kick at me, but she was barefoot and the heavy leather of my trousers muted those blows. She ducked her head then and seized my sleeve in her teeth, worrying it as if it were prey. But good wool was all she gripped, so I let her chew at it. When her biting did not bring her release, she flung her head back, thudding it against my chest. It was not pleasant, but as long as I kept my chin up, I could withstand it. Having so bravely immobilized my scrawny opponent, I craned to see what was happening below me. In the pit of sliding snow, Eliania had reached her mother. She crouched over Oeta, blade ready, her last line of defense as Peyotta fought two of the pale woman's dead-eyed guards. I did not know if Eliania was poised to hold off attackers or deal her mother's death blow before she could be taken again. For a heart-stopping moment, I could not see Dutiful. Then I caught a glimpse of him past Peyotta. He stood squarely in the mouth of the hole from which the Narcheska and Pyotr had emerged. His knife was red, and whoever was down there was not getting past him.
"We are attacked!"
Chade's skilled warning reached me at the same moment that shouts turned my head. I looked down toward our camp. From somewhere, the pale woman's minions had appeared to fall upon our reduced and rattled party. It looked as if they were trying to prevent anyone from going to Tintaglia's aid, though none of them were yet brave enough to attack the fallen dragon. I had a glimpse of my old mentor as I had never before seen him. Feet braced, blade in hand, Chade stood beside Longwick. Thick crouched behind them, wailing, his arms wrapped protectively over his head.
"Thick, push at them, like you push at me. Not all of them will give way, but some will. Fight back. Tell them, go away and don't see us. Please, Thick."
Despair washed over me as I gripped the still struggling girl to me. I dared not let her go, but while I held her, I was useless to do anything else. Thick had not reacted to my suggestion, I thought. And then I saw the little man lift one of his arms and peer out like a fearful child. Then, face set in a grimace, I felt a faint wash of the skill he directed at their attackers.
"Go away! Go away! Go away! Go away!"
I saw at least two of the pale woman's warriors do just that, abruptly turning their backs on the battle and striding away as if they had suddenly remembered urgent business elsewhere. Several others seemed to lose the momentum of their attacks, reduced to defending themselves as they suddenly wondered why they were there and attacking us.
"Do it again, Thick. Help me."
I could feel Chade's failing wind in that skilling. His sword weighed as much as the earth, and he had never liked seeing a man's eyes when he killed him. Then I felt a red wash of pain as a blade slipped up the top of his forearm. I saw Thick spring back, gripping his own arm.
"Chade, block your pain. Thick is feeling it. Thick, tell the pain to go away. Give it to the bad men. You can do it."
Then a buffet of wind from above made me crouch like a field mouse that feels the wash of an owl's wings above him. The dragons were back, fighting in terrible silence, save for the battering rush of their wings and the dull impacts they dealt to one another. They had soared high, locked in their frenzy. Cowering, I stared up at them and thought I knew Rawbred's strategy. He clung to Icefire, his jaws clenched on the back of the other dragon's neck. Icefire was expending most of his energy in an effort to stay aloft. Well, he knew he could not hope to defeat the stone dragon on the ground. The frailer dragon twisted and writhed, trying to escape the stone dragon's deadly grip. They could come down on top of us.
"Get out of there!" I roared down at Dutiful. "The dragons are falling!"
Dutiful looked up, startled, and then leapt back to avoid his opponent's blade. The prince shouted something toward Pyotr and the Narcheska. Pyotr had finished one of his men, and the other was retreating from him. The Narcheska seized her mother's ankle and began to drag her out of the pit, all the while keeping her blade at the ready. I reached a hand to her as she got closer to me, then seized her by the sword wrist and hauled her up and over the edge of the pit. She dragged her mother gracelessly behind her. An instant later, I had to make good my grip on her little sister again as she spat and struggled. Eliania dragged her mother away from the edge and then screamed,
"Get out of there! They're falling!"
She was right. The dragons were a struggling knot that was plummeting, larger and larger towards us. Dutiful and Pyotr both fled their battles, the treacherous ice tumbling and sliding under their feet as they struggled to move uphill and out of the collapsed pit. Eliania, dragging her mother by her ankles, was beating her own retreat, desperately shrieking at Dutiful and Pyotr to hurry, hurry. I stooped, seized the little girl, and followed her. I knew there was nothing else I could do, and yet I felt a coward as I ran. Then, his boots pounding the ice, Dutiful passed me. He reached the Narcheska and, stooping, scooped up her mother and threw her across his shoulders. A moment later, Pyotr's hand fell heavily on my shoulder, pushing me faster as we fled together. The shadows of the falling dragon spread wider around us. I felt stupefied and dizzy for a moment, and then staggered on. We caught up to Dutiful and the women. Eliania pointed upward. wordlessly. Icefire had shaken free of Rawbread. His frantically beating wings bore him higher and higher as Rawbread plummeted gracelessly back toward the earth, his outspread wings able to do little more than break the force of his heavy body's descent. The crash of his impact shook the icy earth. He had landed half in the pit and half on the edge where I had been standing but moments before. I hoped he was dead. But he slowly rolled to his feet and shook out his wings. His blunt head quested on his thick neck, turning this way and that. Then, like a squat lizard digging his way out of mud, his powerful limbs moved, and he crawled out of the pit on his belly, his tail lashing angrily as it churned the snow behind him. He seemed to stare right at me, and my entrails turned to ice in that glare. Then, like a sharply reined horse, he flung back his head and shook it in frustration. His eyes, lackluster in contrast to Tintaglia's whirling silver, looked past me and fixed on the downed female dragon. He diverted from us and lumbered toward her, snorting angrily. I became aware of the pale woman's skilled exhortations to him to kill the female, and all would be well, that he then could sate his anger and hunger as he pleased. But first, kill the female. Nothing stood between him and triumph now. She could not fight him. But the pale woman was wrong. My heart fell as I perceived that Tintaglia still had two defenders. Blind Burric stood next to the dragon, his folded cloak pressed hard to her neck as he sought to quell her bleeding. The smoking of the fabric made me wonder of what stuff dragon blood was made. Burric was intent on his task, and Tintaglia's head on her long neck was coiled back protectively toward her body. They both seemed unaware of the lumbering death that made his ponderous way down the hill toward them. But Swift was not. He stood before her, an ant protecting a castle. The fool's brightly painted arrow flew from his bow to splinter uselessly against the stone dragon. Undaunted, he drew another from his quiver, knocked it, and drew it back. From some reserve of courage that seemed too large for such a small boy to contain, he took two steps forward, toward the dragon. He let fly again, with as futile a result. Still he stood his ground as he pulled out yet another arrow. To reach Tintaglia, Rawbread would have to trample him. I saw Swift call a warning back to his father over his shoulder. An arrow was set to Swift's bow, and all I could do was watch helplessly as the stone dragon's relentless gaze fixed on the boy. Abruptly, Rawbread broke into a clumsy gallop. Swift looked up at his death, and his mouth stretched wide in a scream that was both terror and defiance. His bow shook in his hands, the head of the grey arrow wobbling wildly, but he stood his ground. Burric lifted his head. He turned. Even now I recall every instant of that moment. I saw him draw breath, and heard, through the ringing of my ears, the deep roar of his outrage that anything would threaten his son. I had never seen him move so swiftly. He threw himself towards Swift and the dragon, his boots throwing up clumps of snow as he ran. Tintaglia lifted her head slightly, feeble witness to his charge. Then Burric was between his boy and the dragon, drawing his belt knife as he ran. It was the most ridiculous and the most courageous attack I've ever witnessed. As he sprang to meet the suddenly bewildered dragon's charge, he drew back his knife. I saw the blade splinter as he drove it against the stony flesh. At the same moment, I felt the blast of wit repel that he levelled at the creature. It was like one of Chade's explosions. It was the fierceness of a stallion defending his herd, the savagery of a wolf or bear that protects its cubs, compounded more from love of what he protected than hatred of what he battled. It was targeted at the dragon, and the prodigious force of that blast dropped the stone beast to his knees. But as Rawbread fell, a wild flap of his heavy wings swatted Burric, flinging the man to one side as if he were nothing. His body spun as he flew. "No!" I cried. But it was done. He hit the frozen snow badly, bending like a flung rag doll, and then skidding away across the ice, spinning as he went. Rawbread lumbered back onto his clawed black feet. He shook his heavy head, and I saw him gasp for breath. Then he advanced, open-mouthed on both Swift and Tintaglia. Swift had turned his head to watch the shattering of his father's body. Now he turned back to the dragon, and the roar that stretched his mouth wide was hatred, pure and simple. With that strength, he drew his bowstring back and back, until I thought the bow itself would splinter. I saw him become his arrow as he locked eyes with the dragon lumbering toward him. He let his shaft fly. True as a father's love, the shining grey missile flew. It struck the dragon's eye and sank in, nearly vanishing. I saw Rawbread begin to lift a forefoot to paw at it. Then he halted abruptly, as if listening to someone. I was aware of the skill the pale woman directed at him as she hysterically commanded him to finish it, kill the bowman, kill the she-dragon, and then he could do whatever he wished at all. I thought Rawbread paused to listen to her. But he did not move again. The drab colour of life fled his skin, as a dull patina of stones settled over him. He remained as he was, wings half lifted, forepaw about to claw the arrow from his eye, jaws agape. A silence of disbelief settled over the whole battle. The stone dragon was dead. An instant later, the girl in my arms came back to life. My wit sense of her blossomed into full bloom. She had stopped struggling at the moment of the dragon's death. Now she suddenly curled into my arms.
"I'm so cold. I'm so hungry,"
she wailed. And then, as I looked down in astonishment at her, she burst into childish tears. A moment," I told her, and hated that I had to set her little bare feet down on the snow. I tore Chade's cloak from my body and settled it around her. It came all the way down to her toes, and as I picked her up again, she pulled her feet up into it gratefully, huddling into a shivering ball in my arms.
"Give her to me! Give her to me!"
Piotr demanded. Tears were streaming down his face, cutting through the blood.
"Oh, little fish! Oh, my Kosi! Eliania, look! Look! Our Kosi has come back to us. She is herself."
The old warrior turned to his niece, and then, as if joy had drained his strength from him, he fell to his knees, holding the child to his chest and murmuring over her. Eliania looked over at us, her heart in her eyes, and then looked down at the woman who sprawled in the snow at her feet. She dropped to her knees by her mother, and her tears came as she said,
"We saved one of them. At least we saved one of them. Mother, I did my best. We tried so hard."
Dutiful looked over at her from where he knelt on the other side of the woman. Gentle as a nurse, he pushed the filthy hair back from her emaciated face.
"No, you saved both of them. She's unconscious, Eliania, but she's back too. I can feel her with my wit sense. Your mother has come back to you too."
"But how can you know this?"
She stared down at the woman's face, not daring yet to hope. Dutiful smiled at her.
"I promise you, I know this is so. It's an old Farseer magic, a gift of my father's lineage."
He stooped again to take up the lax woman.
"Let's get her to warmth and shelter, and food. The battle seems to be over for now."
"They all just stopped fighting when the dragon died," Chade confirmed for me as I stood and peered out over the battlefield below us. "It was as if they all just suddenly lost heart."
"No. They regained it. It's hard to explain, Chade, but I feel it with the wit. Her servants were partially forged, but with the dragon's death all that was taken and put into him came back to them. The same thing happened to the Narcheska's mother and sister.
They're no longer forged. Have the Outlanders speak to those we fought. Offer them food and welcome, and comfort them. They may be very confused. I allowed my eyes to wander over the battlefield below me, and saw the truth of my own thought. The pale woman's soldiers, to a man, had dropped their weapons. One man stood, his hands clapped over his ears, weeping. Another had seized one of his fellows by the shoulder and was laughing wildly as he spoke to him. A small group of men stood clustered around the stone dragon. Lifeless, it had settled unevenly into the glacier, an ugly statue set awry. But strangest of all was that Tintaglia had come to her feet. She walked stiff-legged as a stalking cat toward the stone dragon. Cautiously she extended her head on her gracile neck. She sniffed the monster, nosed it cautiously, and then without warning struck it a ringing blow with her clawed forepaw. The stone dragon rocked stiffly in the snow, but did not fall over. Nonetheless, Tintaglia lifted her head high on her long neck and trumpeted her triumph over her foe. Blood might still ooze from the bites and scratches he had dealt her, but she claimed victory as hers. And around her, men raised their voices to join their cries of triumph to hers. If ever there had been a stranger sight than this dragon celebrating amidst human cheering, then no minstrel has ever told it. From high above, a trumpeting call echoed hers. Battered and tattered, Icefire circled in a wide spiral above us. He banked his wings and slid down the sky, swooping over us in a lower circuit. On the ground, Tintaglia threw back her head and bugled again. Around her throat, panels of her scales suddenly stood up like a mane, and a crest on her head, scarcely noticeable before, stood erect and silver like a crown. A wash of colour went over her, from the deepest blue to brightest silver. The men who had gathered around her drew back. When she leapt from the ground to the air, it was effortless in the manner of a cat floating from the floor up to a tabletop. Her wings opened as she sprang, and with three beats of them she was climbing. Icefire immediately tipped his wings and stroked them frantically, but the female easily outdistanced him as they climbed. He trumpeted after her lustily, but she did not bother to reply. Her wings carried her up and up, until, to my straining eyes, she might have been a silver gull winging overhead. Icefire, almost twice her size, starved and tattered, battered his way through the sky in pursuit of her. I blinked as they passed before the sun. Then they were spiraling together. His deep cries were a challenge to all the world, but her higher calls were a defiance and mockery of him alone. He was above her for a moment, and then she tipped her wings and slid away from him. So I thought. Instead, he clapped his wings to his body and fell upon her, his wide-open jaws so scarlet that even at that distance I perceived it, before his teeth clamped onto her outstretched neck. Then his larger wings overshadowed hers, and suddenly their beating synchronized. He pulled her tight against him, his longer tail wrapping hers as he arched around her. I knew what I witnessed. By that mating flight, there would be dragons in our skies again. I stared up at that wonder, at their casual flaunting of their return to life, and wondered what we had restored to the world.
"I do not understand," the Narcheska exclaimed in horror. "She came all this way to save him, and now he attacks her? Look at them fight!"
Dutiful cleared his throat.
"I don't think they're fighting." "Then, yes, they are. Look at how he bites her. Why does he seize her like that if not to hurt her?"
Eliania shaded her eyes with one hand as she looked up in wonder at them. Her dark hair fell tangled down her shoulders and back, and her uplifted chin bared the long, straight column of her neck. Her tunic strained over her breasts. Dutiful made a small sound in his throat. He lifted his eyes from looking at her, and his gaze went from me to Pyotr. Her uncle had one arm around his sister's shoulders and held Kossi in his other. I think the prince decided that our opinion of the matter no longer concerned him. He stepped closer to Eliania and took her in his arms.
"I'll show you," he said to her astonishment.
He clasped her firm and close, and lowered his mouth to hers. Despite all that had befallen me that day, despite every loss I had sustained, I found myself smiling. That which surged between the dragons above must affect any man sensitive to the skill. The Narcheska broke the kiss at last, lowering her brow to his shoulder. She laughed softly.
"Oh, oh,"
she said. Then she lifted her face again to be kissed. I looked aside. Oetar did not. She was scandalized. Despite her rags and filth, her reaction was regal.
"Piotr, you allow a farmer to kiss our Narcheska?"
He laughed aloud. I was shocked to realize it was the first time I'd ever heard the man laugh. "No, my sister, but she does, and she allots to him what he has earned. There is much explaining to do yet, but I promise you, what happens there is not against her will." He smiled. "And what is a man that he should oppose the will of a woman?"
"It is not proper,"
Oetar replied primly, and despite her stained dress and caked hair, her words were that of a Narcheska of the Out-Islands. It struck me how completely she had come back to herself. Abruptly, it came to me that if the fool still lived, then with the dragon's death, whatever forging had been done to him would have come undone as well. Wild hope leapt in me, and the world lurched around me. "The fool!" I exclaimed. And then, when Pyotr looked at me in disapproval to see if I mocked the prince, I clarified, "The tawny man, Lord Golden, he might yet live." I turned and ran over the crusted snow. I reached the edge of what had been our pit and tried to find a safe way down into it. The upheaval of the dragons had made it a treacherous place. The opening that Pyotr and the Narcheska had emerged from was gone. Rawbred's final landing in the side of the pit and his struggles to get out of it had obscured that gap into the pale woman's palace. But I knew where it had been, and surely, surely, it could not be buried that deeply. I set out down the unstable slope, trying to hurry, and yet keep my footing as the broken ice crunched and then cascaded past me. I halted and forced myself to walk more carefully. I picked my way down the sliding slope, hating the delay. Every chunk of ice I dislodged now was yet another I must move. The opening had been at the deepest end of the pit. I was nearly to it when I heard someone call my name. I halted and looked over my shoulder. Pyotr stood at the edge of the excavation, looking down on me. He shook his head, his eyes full of pity. He spoke bluntly. "Give it up, Bajalok. He's dead. Your comrade is dead. I'm sorry. We saw him when we were searching the cells for our people. I had promised myself that if he were still alive, we would try to steal him, too. But he wasn't. We were too late. I'm sorry." I stood staring up at him. Suddenly, I couldn't see him. The contrast between the brightness of the day and his dark silhouette seemed to blind me. Cold crept up me, followed by a wave of numbness. I thought I would faint. I sat down very slowly in the ice. I hated the stupid words that came from my mouth. "Are you sure?" Pyotr nodded, and then said reluctantly, "Very sure. They had..." He stopped speaking suddenly. When he resumed, he said flatly, "He was dead. He could not have lived through that. He was dead." He took a breath, and then sighed it out slowly. "They are calling for you down at the camp. The boy, Swift, he is with the dying man. They want you there." The dying man? Burek? He jolted back into my thoughts like one of Chade's explosions. Yes, I would lose him, too. It was too much, far too much. I put my face down in my hands and curled up, rocking back and forth in the snow. Too much. Too much. "I think you should hurry," Blackwater's voice reached me from some distant place. Then I heard someone else say quietly, "You go tend to your own people. I'll see to mine." I heard someone working his way down the slope of ice to me. but I didn't care. I just sat there, trying to die, trying to let go of a life where I failed everyone that I cared about. Then a hand fell heavily on my shoulder, and Webb said, "Get up, Fitz Chivalry. Swift needs you." I shook my head childishly. I would never, never let anyone depend on me again. "Get up," he said more sternly. "We've lost enough people today. We're not going to lose you, too." I lifted my head and looked up at him. I felt forged. "I was lost a long time ago," I told him. Then I took a deep breath, stood up, and followed him.
Chapter 26 Healings. The Chalcedian practice of tattooing one's slaves with a special mark of ownership began as a fashion among the nobility. In the early days of it, only the most valuable slaves, slaves one expected to own for a lifetime, were so marked. The custom seems to have escalated when Lord Grat and Lord Port, both powerful nobles in the Chalcedian court, entered a rivalry to display their wealth. Jewelry, horses and slaves were the measure of wealth at that time, and Lord Grat chose to have all of his horses prominently branded and all of his slaves tattooed. Ranks of both accompanied him everywhere he went. It is said that Lord Port, in imitation of his rival, actually bought hundreds of cheap slaves of little or no standing as craftsmen or academics, simply for the purpose of tattooing them as his and displaying them. At that time, in Chalced, some slave craftsmen and artisans and courtesans were allowed by their masters to accept outside commissions. Occasionally, one of these privileged slaves would earn enough to purchase his freedom. Many masters were understandably reluctant to let such valuable slaves go, as tattoos of ownership could not be removed from the slave's face without substantial scarring, and freedom papers were widely falsified. It was difficult for former slaves to prove they had earned their freedom. Slave owners took advantage of this by creating expensive freedom rings, earrings of gold or silver, often with jewels, the design unique to each noble family that indicated a particular slave had earned his freedom. Often it took a slave years of service after he had bought his freedom to purchase the expensive earring that showed he was truly free to move about Chalced as he pleased on his own recognizance. Fedren's History of Chalced's Slave Customs. I am no stranger to the aftermath of battle. I've walked across bloody earth and stepped over hacked bodies, yet never before had I been in a place where the futility of war was so clearly illustrated. Warriors bound up the wounds they had dealt to one another, and out-islanders who had fought us now anxiously asked the Hetgerd men for news of relatives and clan lands left years ago. Like men wakened from a legendary sleep they were, groping after lost lives, trying to cross a rift of years. It was too clear that they well remembered all that they had done as servants of the Pale Woman. I recognized one of the guards who had dragged me before her. He looked hastily aside from my gaze, and I did not confront him. Piotr had already told me the only thing I needed to know. I made my way through our camp. With an almost unseemly haste, it was being struck. Two badly injured men, both from the Pale Woman's force, were already loaded on the sleds, and the tents were coming down. A hasty ice cairn was being assembled over three dead men. All of them had belonged to her. Ice fire had eaten Eagle, the Hetgerd man who had fallen to the dragon. There would be no entombment for him. The other two men we had lost, Fox and Deft, had already been buried in the collapse of the pit. No sense digging them up only to bury them again, I supposed. It seemed a hasty and irreverent way to leave our fallen, but I sensed the emotion that drove it. There was an aura of haste to this departure, as if the sooner we could leave this place, the faster the Pale Woman would become a creature of the past. I hoped that she, too, was entombed beneath the immense fall of ice. Webb walked beside me, and Chade came hurrying to meet me. Someone had bandaged his arm. "This way," he told me, and led me to where Burrick lay in the snow. Swift knelt beside him. They had not tried to move him.
There was a wrenching wrongness to how his body lay. The spine is not meant to twist like that. I dropped to my knees beside him, surprised to find his eyes open. His hand spidered feebly against the snow. I slipped mine underneath it. He was breathing shallowly, as if hiding from the pain lurking in the lower half of his body. He managed a single word.
Alone.
I looked at Webb and Chade. Without a word, they withdrew. Burrick's eyes met Swift's. The boy looked stubborn. Burrick took a slightly deeper breath. There was a colour in his skin around his mouth and eyes, a strange darkening.
Just a moment,
he said huskily to his son. Swift bowed his head slightly and walked away from us. Burrick, I said, but an almost sharp movement of his hand against mine bid me stop. I saw him gather the remnants of his strength. He paced himself, taking a breath for each phrase he muttered.
Go home,
he said, and then, commanding me,
take care of them.
Molly, the lads. I started to shake my head. He asked the impossible of me. For a moment his hand tightened on mine, a shadow of his old grip.
Yes,
you will.
You must. For me.
Another breath. He furrowed his brow, as if making an important choice.
Malta and Ruddy. When she comes in season, not Brusque. Ruddy.
He wagged one finger at me, as if I had thought to argue that decision. He took a deeper breath.
Wish I would see that foal.
He blinked his eyes slowly, then...
Swift!
He said painfully. Swift! I shouted, and saw the loitering boy lift his head and start to run back to us. Just before he reached us, Burrick spoke again. He almost smiled as he said,
I was the better man for her.
A breath. In a whisper.
She still would have chosen you. If you'd come back.
Then Swift flung himself to his knees in the snow beside Burrick, and I gave my place over to him. Chade and Webb had come back with a heavy blanket. Webb spoke. We're going to try to scoop out the snow under you and sling you in the blanket to put you on the sled. The prince has already released the bird that will summon the ships to fetch us back to Zillig.
Doesn't matter,
Burrick said. His hand closed on Swift's as he shut his eyes. A few moments later I saw his hand go lax. Move him now, I suggested, while he's unconscious. I helped them, digging in the snow under Burrick's body and sliding the blanket beneath him. Despite our efforts to be gentle, he moaned as we moved him, and my wit sense of him faded a notch. I said nothing, but I'm sure that Swift was as aware of it as I was. The situation didn't need words. We loaded him onto the sled with the other two injured men. Just before we left that place, I looked up into the clear sky, searching, but there was no sign of either dragon. Not even a thank you, I commented to Webb. He shrugged wordlessly, and we set out. For the rest of the day I either walked beside Burrick or took turns pulling the sled. Swift walked always where he could see his father, but I do not think Burrick's eyes opened again that day. Thick rode on the tail of the sled, huddled in a blanket and staring. Kossi and Oetr rode on the other sled, well bundled against the cold. Piotr pulled it, humming a tune as he trudged along, while the Narcheska and Dutiful walked alongside it. They were in front of us. I could not hear what the Narcheska was telling her mother, but I could guess. Her eye, when it fell on Dutiful, was slightly less disapproving, but mostly her gaze lingered on her daughter, with pride. The remaining Hedgerd men led us, probing the snow for cracks as we went. Webb and then Chade came to walk alongside me for a time. There was nothing to say, and that was what we said. I counted it up to myself, mostly because I could not stop my mind from doing so. My prince had led here 12 men plus Swift and Thick. 6 Hedgerd men had come to oversee us, 20 in all, plus the Fool and Burrick, 22. The Pale Woman had killed Hest and Riddle and the Fool. Burrick was dying from the injury her dragon had dealt him. Eagle had died in the rain of ice from Chade's explosion. Fox and Deft were likewise lost. 16 of us would return to Zillig, assuming that Churry and Drub had survived on the beach alone. I drew a deep breath. We were bringing the Narcheska's mother and sister home. Surely that counted for something. And 8 out-islanders would be going back to their homes, men their families had long believed dead. I tried to feel some sort of satisfaction, but could not find it. This last and briefest battle of the Red Ship War had been the most costly to me. Pyotr called a halt in the grey of evening, and we made a quiet camp. We used 2 of the tents to erect a makeshift shelter around the sled that the injured men were on so that we would not have to move them. The other 2 were able to speak and eat, but Burek was still and quiet. I brought Swift food and drink and sat with him for a time, but after a while I sensed that he wished to be alone with his father. I left him there and went out to walk under the stars. There is no true dark to a night in that land, only the brightest of the stars showed. The night was cold, and the constant wind blew, heaping loose snow against the shelters. I could not think of anywhere I wanted to be or anything I wanted to do. Chade and the prince were crowded into the Narcheska's tent with Pyotr's family. There was triumph and rejoicing there. Both were foreign emotions to me. The Hetgerd men and the recovered out-islanders were having a reunion of sorts. I walked past a tiny fire where Owl was matter-of-factly burning a dragon and serpent tattoo off a man's forearm. The smell of roasting flesh rode the wind while the man grunted and then roared with the pain. Dutiful's witchcoterie, son Swift, had also crammed themselves into a small tent. I heard Webb's deep voice as I went past and caught the gleam of a cat's eye peering out. Doubtless they shared the prince's triumph. They had freed the dragon, and he'd won the Narcheska's regard. Longwick sat alone before a small fire in front of a darkened tent. I wondered where he had got the brandy I smelled. I nearly walked past him with a silent nod, but something in his face told me that here was where I belonged tonight. I hunkered down and held my hands over the tiny fire. "Captain," I greeted him.
"Of what?"
he retorted. He rolled his head back with a crackling sound, and then sighed.
"Hest, riddle, deft. Doesn't say much for me that all the men who accompanied me here are dead. And I still live."
"I'm still alive," I pointed out to him. He nodded. Then he gestured with his chin toward the tent and said,
"Your half-wit's in there asleep. He looked a bit lost tonight, so I took him in."
"Thanks." I knew a moment of guilt, and then asked myself if I should have left Burek to tend Thick, and reflected that perhaps having someone to oversee had been the best thing for Longwick. He shifted, and then offered me a brandy flask. It was a soldier's flask, dented and scratched, his own hoard of spirits, and a gift to be respected. I drank from it sparingly before returning it to him.
"Sorry about your friend, that golden fella."
"Yes."
"You went back away."
"We were boys together."
"Were you? Sorry."
"Yes."
"I hope that bitch died slowly. Riddle and Hest were good men."
"Yes." I wondered if she had died at all. If she was still alive, could she be any threat to us? Dragon, rawbred, and forged servants had all been taken from her. She was skilled, but I could think of no way she could use that against all of us. If she was alive, she was as alone as I was. Then I sat for a time wondering which I hoped, that she was dead or alive and suffering. Finally it came to me. I was too tired to care. Sometime later Longwick asked me,
"Are you really him? Chivalry's bastard."
"Yes." He nodded slowly to himself, as if that explained something.
"More lives than a cat," he said quietly.
"I'm going to bed," I told Longwick.
"Sleep well,"
he said. And we both laughed bitterly. I found my pack and bedding and took it into Longwick's tent. Thick stirred slightly as I made my bed alongside him.
"I'm cold,"
he mumbled. "Me too. I'll sleep against your back, that will help." I lay down in my blankets, but I didn't sleep. I wondered useless things. What had she done to the fool? How had she killed him? Had he been completely forged before she killed him? If she'd sent him into the dragon, did that mean he'd felt some final pain when the stone dragon died? Stupid. stupid questions. Thick shifted heavily against my back.
"I can't find her,"
he said quietly. "Who?" I asked sharply. The pale woman was large in my thoughts.
"Nettle. I can't find her."
My conscience smote me. My own daughter, the man who had raised her dying, and I hadn't even thought of reaching out to her. Thick spoke again.
"I think she's afraid to go to sleep."
Well, I can't blame her. Only myself.
"Are we going back home now?"
"Yes."
"We didn't kill the dragon?"
"No, we didn't." There was a long pause, and I hoped he had gone back to sleep. Then he asked me quietly,
"Are we going home on a boat?"
I sighed. His childish concern was the only thing that could have weighed me heavier. I tried to find sympathy for him. It was difficult. "It's the only way we can go home, Thick. You know that."
"I don't want to."
"I don't blame you."
"Me neither."
He sighed heavily. After a time, he said,
"So this was our adventure, and the prince and the princess get married and live happily ever after, with many children to warm them in their old age."
He had probably heard that phrase thousands of times in his life. It was a common way for a minstrel to end a hero tale. "Perhaps," I said cautiously. "Perhaps."
"What happens to the rest of us?"
Longwick came into the tent. Quietly he began to make up his bed. From the way he moved, I suspected he had finished his brandy. "The rest of us go on with our lives, Thick. You'll go back to Buckkeep and serve the prince. When he becomes the king, you'll be at his side." I reached to find his happy ending. "And you'll live well, with pink sugar cakes and new clothes whenever you need them."
"And Nettle,"
he said with satisfaction.
"Nettle is at Buckkeep now. She's going to teach me how to make good dreams. At least that's what she said. Before the dragon and all."
"Did she? That's good." With that, he seemed to settle for the night. In a short time, his breathing took on the slower rhythm of sleep. I closed my eyes and wondered if Nettle could teach me how to make good dreams. I wondered if I'd ever have the courage to meet her. I didn't want to think about her right now. If I thought about her, then I had to think about telling her about Burric.
"What will you do, Lord Fitzchivalry?"
Longwick's question in the dark was like a voice out of the sky. "That isn't me," I said quietly. "I'll go back to the Six Duchies and be Tom Badgerlock."
"Seems like a lot of people know your secret now."
"I think they are all men who know how to hold their tongues, and will do so, at Prince Dutiful's request." He shifted in his blankets.
"Some might do so merely at Lord Fitzchivalry's request."
I laughed in spite of myself, then managed to say, "Lord Fitzchivalry would greatly appreciate that."
"Very well, but I think it's a shame. You deserve better. What of glory? What of men knowing what you have done, and who you are, and giving you the acclaim you deserve for your success? Don't you want to be remembered for what you've done?"
I didn't need to think long. What man has not played that game late at night, staring into the fire's embers? I had been down the road of what might have been so often that I knew every crossroad and pitfall in it. I'd rather be forgotten for the things people think I've done. And I'd give it all if I could forget the things I failed to do. And there we left it. I suppose I must have slept at some point, because I awoke in the pre-dawn grey. I crawled from my blankets to keep from disturbing Thick, and went immediately to Burric's bedside. Swift slept curled beside him, holding his father's hand. My wit sense of the stablemaster told me he was sinking away from us. He was going to die. I went to Chade and Dutiful and woke them. "I want something from you," I told them. Dutiful peered at me blearily from his blankets. Chade sat up slowly in his bedding, alerted by my voice, that this was a serious matter. "What?" "I want the coterie to try to heal Burric." When no one spoke, I added, "Now, before he slips any further away." The others are going to realize that you and Thick are more than what you seem, Chade pointed out to me. It is why I have left my own injury alone, not that it compares to Barrick's. All my secrets seem to have spilled out on this island anyway. If I must live with those consequences, then I'd like to have something to show for it. For all I've lost here, I'd like to send Swift home to Molly with his father. Her husband, Chade reminded me quietly. Don't you think I know that? Don't you think I see all the possible consequences? Go wake Thick, the prince suggested, as he threw back his blankets. I know you want to hurry, but I suggest you get him a good breakfast before we try this. He can't focus on anything when he's hungry, and mornings are not his best time, so let's at least feed him. Shouldn't we think this through a bit before... Chade began, but Dutiful cut him off. This is the only thing Fitz has ever asked of me. He's getting it, Lord Chade. And he's getting it now. Well, as close to now as I can manage. As soon as Thick has had some breakfast. He began to dress, and with a groan, Chade threw back his blankets. You act as if I hadn't thought of this myself. I have. Chivalry sealed Barrick to the skill. Doesn't anyone beside me remember that? Chade asked wearily. We can try, Dutiful replied stubbornly. And we did. It seemed to take an eternity to get a breakfast made for Thick, and while he consumed it in his careful and thorough way, I tried to explain to Swift what I wanted to do. I feared to give him too much hope, and at the same time I wanted him to understand the risks of what we did. If our attempt at mending Burrick's crumpled body was too much for his physical reserves and he died, I did not want the lad to think we had killed him recklessly. I had thought it would be a difficult thing to explain. More difficult was getting Swift to pause and consider what I was telling him. I tried to call him aside, to speak to him, for the bear was not far away, tending the out-islander injured, but Swift refused to leave his father's side for even a moment, so finally I spoke to him where he sat. At the first mention that Prince Dutiful might be able to use the Farseer magic to mend his father's body, Swift became so avid that I am sure my cautions and warnings of possible failure went right past him. The boy looked like a castaway, his eyes dark-circled and sunken in grief. Whatever sleep he had taken last night had not rested him. When I asked him if he had eaten, he just shook his head as if such an idea exhausted him. "When will you start?" he demanded of me for the third time, and I surrendered. "As soon as the rest of them get here," I told him. And almost at that moment, Chade lifted the flap of the rough tent we had erected over the sled and entered. Dutiful and Thick crowded in behind him. The number of people in the crude shelter now threatened to collapse it, and with an impatient gesture, Dutiful suggested, "Let's get this down and out of the way. It will be more distraction than shelter while we work." So while Swift chewed his lip impatiently, Longwick and I took down the screening canvas and bundled it up for transport. By the time we'd finished, rumour of what we were doing had begun to trickle through the camp, and all gathered to watch. I did not relish working in front of everyone, let alone revealing to all how intimate my connection to the prince was. Yet there was no help for it. We gathered around Burrick's body. It was hard to persuade Swift to step aside and let me put my hands on him, yet Webb at last drew him aside. He stood behind the lad and held him, as if he were a much younger boy. Wit and arms, he wrapped him in a comforting embrace, and I sent him a grateful look. He nodded to me, acknowledging it, and bidding me begin. Chade and Dutiful and Thick joined hands, looking like men about to play some child's game. I shivered with dread of what we were about to attempt, and tried to ignore the avid attention of the onlookers. Cockle, the minstrel, was wide-eyed and tense with focus. The out-islanders, both Hetgerd and rescued, watched us with suspicion. Piotr stood at a slight distance, his women around him, his face solemn and intent. When I was a few years older than Swift, I had tried, at Burrick's suggestion, to draw skill strength from him as my father had. I had failed, and not just because I had not known what I was doing. My father had used Burrick as a king's man, as a source of physical strength for his skill work. But any man so used also becomes a conduit to the user, and so chivalry had sealed Burrick off to other skill users, so that no one could use him as a means to attack chivalry or spy on him. Today, I would pit my strength and that of Dutiful's coterie against my father's ancient barricade, and see if I could break past it into Burrick's soul. I reached a hand toward the coterie, and Thick took it. I set my other hand on Burrick's chest. My wit told me that he lingered in his body reluctantly. The animal that Burrick dwelt in was hopelessly injured. If his body had been a horse, Burrick would have put it down by now. That was an unsettling thought, and I pushed it aside. Instead, I tried to set my wit aside and hone my skill to the sharpness of a blade. I banished all other thoughts and sought for some place to pierce him with that awareness. I found none. I sensed the rest of the coterie, sensed their anxiety and hovering readiness. But I could find no place to apply that eagerness. I could sense Burrick there, but my awareness of him skated over the surface, unable to penetrate. I did not know how my father had sealed him, and had no idea how to undo it. I do not know how long I strove to break past his walls. I only know that at length Thick dropped my hand to wipe a sweaty palm down the front of his jerkin.
"That one's too hard,"
he proclaimed.
"Do this easy one instead."
He did not ask anyone's permission, but leaned in past Burrick to set his hand on the shoulder of one of the injured Out-Islanders. I was not even holding Thick's hand, but in that instant I knew the Out-Islander. He had been the Pale Woman's slave for he knew not how many years. He wondered if his son had prospered in his mother's house, and wondered too about his sister's three sons. He had promised to teach them swordsmanship all those years ago. Had anyone stepped forward to do that duty for him? These thoughts tormented him as much as his injury, a sweeping sword wound that Bear had dealt him. It had laid open the flesh of his chest and bitten deep into his upper arm. He'd lost a lot of blood, and that weakened him. If he could find the strength to live, his body would heal. Then, without regard to that, his flesh began to knit itself up. The man gave a roar and lifted a hand to clutch at his closing wound, just like a rent garment sewing itself up. His flesh reached for the severed ends of itself. Bits that were dead or past repair were expulsed from him. In a sort of horror, I watched the pads of flesh on the man's face melt away. Luckily for us, he was a burly man, possessed of the reserves that his body now burned. He sat up suddenly on his pallet, and wrenched the caked bandages from his body, throwing them aside. All the witnesses gasped. His newly healed flesh shone, not with the poreless sheen of a scar, but with the health of a child's body. It was a pale and hairless stripe down his swarthy body. He stared down at himself, and then, with a rough laugh of amazement, he thumped himself on the chest as if to convince himself of its soundness. A moment later, he had swung his legs over the side of the sled and hopped off it, to caper barefoot in the snow. An instant later he was back to sweep Thick off his stubby legs and swing him in a wide circle before setting the astonished little man back on his feet. In his own language he thanked him, calling him Ada's hands, an Out-Islander phrase I did not understand. It conveyed something to Bear, though, for he instantly went to the other wounded man on the sled, and throwing back the man's coverings, gestured at him for Thick to come to him. Thick didn't even glance at the rest of us. I scarcely had a thought to spare for him or what he did. My gaze was fixed on Swift, who stared at me with eyes gone blank and hopeless. I held out a useless hand to him, palm up. He swallowed and looked away from me. Then he came not to me but to Burrick. He took his place beside his father and picked up his darkening hand. He looked at me, a question in his eyes. "I'm sorry," I said, through the exclamations of amazement as the second Out-Islander stood healed of his injuries. "He is sealed. My father closed him off to other skill users. I cannot get in to help him." He looked away from me, his disappointment so deep that it verged on hatred. Not necessarily hatred of me, but of the moment, of the other men who were rising, renewed, and of those who rejoiced over them. Webb had moved away from Swift to allow him his anger. I saw no sense in trying to speak any more to him just then. Thick seemed to have mastered the knack of skill healing, and with moderate supervision from Dutiful he moved on to heal the two men who had burned off their Pale Woman tattoos the night before. Pale, smooth skin replaced oozing and blistered flesh. From being an object of disdain, Thick was suddenly the prince of their regard, and a living embodiment of Ada's hands. I heard the Bear begging Prince Dutiful's pardon for their former disrespect of his servant. They had not realized that he possessed Ada's gift, and now they understood the great value the prince placed on him and why he would have brought him to a battle. It hurt me to see Thick suddenly bask in their approval, just as he had cringed before their disdain. I felt somehow betrayed that he could so swiftly forget how they had spurned him. Yet I was glad that he could, even as I recognized the contradiction of it. Almost I wished I could be as simple as he was, and accept that people truly meant the expressions they wore. Chade came up behind me, and set his hand lightly on my shoulder. I turned to him with a sigh, expecting some task. Instead, the old man put his arm around me. His grip tightened, and he spoke softly by my ear.
"I'm sorry, boy. We tried. And I'm sorry, too, for the fool's death. We did not always agree, he and I, but he did for Shrewd what no one else could have done. And the same for Cotricken. If we opposed one another this last time, well, be assured, I had not forgotten those former times. As it was, he still won."
He glanced up at the sky, as if he almost expected to see dragons overhead.
"Won, and left us to deal with whatever it was he won for us. I don't doubt that it will be as unpredictable as he was. And that, I am sure, would please him. He told me he would die here. I never completely believed him. If I had, there are things I would have said to him." I sighed, suddenly filled with the futility of such thoughts, and of all the things I had meant to do and never done. I groped within myself, trying to find some meaningful thought or sentiment. There was nothing to think or to say. The fool's absence filled me, leaving no room for anything else. We moved on that day, and most of us were in high spirits. Burrick rode alone on the sled now, silent and unmoving, fading more as the day passed. Swift walked on one side of him and I on the other, and we spoke not at all. On our rest halts, I trickled a little water into Burrick's mouth. Each time he swallowed it. Even so, I knew that he was dying, and I didn't lie to Swift about it. Night came, and we halted and made food. Thick had no lack of friends now, ready to look after him, and he loved the attention. I tried not to feel abandoned by him. All the days that I had wished to be free of his care, and now that I was, I wished I had the distraction of it again. Webb came to Swift and me, bringing food for the boy and nodding to me that I should take a rest from my vigil. Yet walking apart from Burrick and Swift only made the night seem colder. I found myself at Longwick's fire when he shared his harvest of gossip with me. Some of the freed out islanders had been with the Pale Woman since the Red Ship War. Once there had been scores of them, but she had relentlessly fed them to the dragons. At first the main settlement had been on the shore near the quarry site, but after the war she had begun to fear that the out-islanders would turn on her. She had also been determined from the beginning that she would make an end of the dragon ice fire. Legend said that the halls and tunnels beneath the glacier had existed for generations. She had waited for the year's low tide to discover the fabled under-ice entry to it. Once within, she had put her men to chipping out the icy ceiling of the treacherous passage, to create a hidden access that could be used at almost any low tide. When she destroyed her beach settlement, she had ordered her servants to transport the larger of the two stone dragons and reassemble him in the great hall of ice. It had been a prodigious task, but she cared nothing for how many men or how much time it consumed. In the years since the war she had dwelt there, extracting tribute from the clans that still feared her or hoped to regain their hostages from her. She struck cruel bargains. For a shipment of food she might return a body, or a promise that the hostage would never be released to shame his family. When I asked Longwick if he thought that knowledge of her habitation was widespread in the out-islands, he shook his head.
I got the sense that it was a matter of shame. No one who paid the bribes would have spoken of it.
I nodded to myself at that. I doubted that many of the Narwhal clan knew the full tale of what had become of Oeta and Kossi, only that they were missing. Well did I know that very large secrets could still remain secrets. So the Pale Woman's kingdom had been built from the labor of half-forged warriors. When one became injured or old or intractable, he was given to the dragon. Many lives had gone into the stone in her futile efforts to animate it,
We had arrived at the waning of her power. Scores served her where once there had been hundreds. Her dragon and the forced labour had consumed them. The pale woman had made efforts of her own to kill Icefire, but had never succeeded in more than tormenting him. She feared to remove the ice that held him, and had never discovered a weapon that effectively pierced his overlapping scales and thick hide. Her hatred and fear of him had been legendary among her slaves. "I still don't understand," I said to Longwick quietly, as we watched the small flames of his fire dying. "Why did they serve her? How did she get forged ones to obey her? The ones I saw in Buck were without loyalties of any kind."
"I do not know. I soldiered in the Red Ship War, and I know what you speak about. The men I talked to said that their memories of their time serving her are dulled. They recall only pain, no pleasure, no scent, no taste of food. Only that they did what she bade them because it was easier than being disobedient. The disobedient were fed to the dragon. I think here we see a more sophisticated use of the forging than any we knew in the Six Duchies. One man told me that when she took all his loyalty and love of his home and family away, it seemed to him that she was the only thing he could serve. And serve he did, though even the blunted memories of what he did for her shame him now.
When I left Longwick and went back to where Barrick rested on the sled, I caught a glimpse of Prince Dutiful and the Narcheska between the tents. They stood, their hands entwined and their heads close together. I wondered how her mother regarded their marriage to come. To her it must seem a strange and sudden alliance with an old enemy. Would she support it when it meant her daughter must leave her mother's house to reign in a distant land? I wondered how Eliania herself felt about it. She had only recently regained her mother and sister. Would she now wish to leave them and travel to the Six Duchies? Webb was sitting with Swift and Burrick when I returned to them. Grief had aged the boy to the edge of manhood. I sat down quietly beside them on the edge of the sled. A makeshift tent draped it to keep the night winds at bay, and a single candle lit it. Despite the blankets that swathed Burrick, his hands were cold when I took one in mine. Swift looked defeated already as he asked me quietly,
"Couldn't you try again? Those others, they heal so quickly. And now they sit and talk and laugh with their fellows around the fire. Why can't you heal my father?"
I'd told him. I repeated it anyway. "Because chivalry closed him to the skill many years ago. Did you know that your father had served Prince Chivalry? That he served him as a king's man, a source of strength for when the king chose to do his magic?" He shook his head, his eyes full of regret.
"I know little of my father, other than as my father. He's a reserved man. He never told us tales of when he was a boy, like Mother tells us stories of Buckkeep Town and her father. He taught me about horses, and caring for them. But that was before."
He halted, then forced himself to go on.
"Before he knew I was witted. Like him. After that he tried to keep me out of the stables and away from the animals as much as possible. That meant I had little time with him. But he didn't talk about the whip much either, other than to tell me he forbade me to touch minds with any beast.
He was much the same with me when I was a boy." I agreed with him. I scratched my neck suddenly, weary and uncertain. What belonged to me? What belonged to Burrick? When I got older, he spoke to me more and explained things more. I think that as you got older, he would have told you more about himself, too. I took a deep breath. Burrick's hand was in mine. I wondered if he would forgive me what I was about to do, or if he would have thanked me. "I remember the first time I saw your father. I was about 5 years old, I think. One of Prince Verity's men took me down the hall to where the guardsmen were eating in the old quarters at Moon's Eye. Prince Chivalry and most of his guard were away, but your father had remained behind, still recovering from the injury to his knee, the one that makes him limp. The first time he was hurt there, it was because he leapt between a wild boar and my father, to save my father from being gutted by the animal's tusks. So, there was Burrick, in a kitchen full of guardsmen, a young man in his fighting prime, dark and wild and hard-eyed, and there was I, suddenly thrust into his care, with no warning to either of us.
Can you imagine it? Even now I wonder what must have gone through his mind when the guardsman first set me down on the table in front of him and announced to all that I was Chivalry's little bastard and Burrick was to have the care of me now. Despite himself, a very small smile crept over Swift's face. So we eased into the night, with me telling him the stories of the rash young man who had raised me. Webb sat by us for some time. I am not sure when he slipped away. When the candle guttered, we lay down on either side of Burrick to keep him warm, and I talked on quietly in the darkness until Swift slept. It seemed to me that my wit sense of Burrick beat stronger in those hours, but perhaps it was only that I had recalled to myself all that he had been to me. Mixed in with my memories of how he had encouraged and disciplined me, of the times when he had righteously punished me and praised me, I now saw more clearly the times when a young single man had curtailed his life for the sake of a small boy. It was humbling to realize that my dependency on him had probably shaped his life as much as his had influenced me. The next morning when I gave Burrick water, his eyelids fluttered a bit. For an instant he looked out at me. Trapped and miserable. Then, "Thanks," he wheezed, but I do not think it was for the water. "Papa?" Swift asked him eagerly, but he had already faded again. We made good time in our travel that day, and when evening came we decided to push on and try to be off the glacier before we stopped for the night. We were full of enthusiasm for that idea. I think we were all weary of camping on ice, but the distance yet to travel proved further than we had believed. On we went, and on, past weariness into the stubborn place where we refused to admit we had misjudged. It was deep into the night before we approached the beach. We saw the welcome sight of watchfires, and before it sank into my weary mind that one fire should have sufficed for two guards, we heard Churry's challenge ring out. Prince Dutiful answered it, and we heard a glad cry of several voices raised, but none of us were prepared to hear Riddle shouting a welcome to us. When I recalled how I had last seen him, it raised the hackles on the back of my neck. I knew one wild moment of irrational hope that the fool, too, would somehow be there. Then I recalled what Piotr had told me, and sorrow drenched me. We were among the last to reach the beach camp. By the time we arrived, all was in an uproar of welcome and storytelling. Nearly an hour passed before I managed to get the tale out of someone. Riddle and 17 Outlander survivors of the Pale Woman's Palace were there. They had come to themselves, probably at the moment of the dragon's slaying. Riddle and his fellow prisoners had been rescued from their dungeon by one of her guard when his sensibilities had come back to him. They had joined forces to find a way out, and Riddle had managed to lead them back to the beach. They were all very confused as to what had led to the recovery of their senses and their liberation. It took all the rest of that night for us to splice the story together for them. Chade summoned me to his tent the next day to be present when Riddle made his full report. I listened to his account of how the Pale Woman's soldiers had fallen upon Hest and him, capturing both of them. Their mistake had been in seeing some of her guards emerge from a hidden entrance to her realm. They could not be allowed to bear that information back to the prince. Riddle was not able to describe coherently how he had been forged. It had to do with the dragon, but every time he attempted to tell about it, he began to tremble so violently that he was unable to go on. At last, and to my relief, Chade gave up on attempting to wring that knowledge out of him. Truly I thought it was information better lost than discovered. He was astonished to know that the fool and I had glimpsed him in the dungeon. He said he did not blame me for leaving him there, that if I had forced the door he would certainly have attacked me for the sake of getting my warm clothing. Yet there was something in his eyes, so deep a shame that someone he knew had seen him in that state that I doubted our fledgling friendship would survive. I did not think I could ever be comfortable again, looking at the man I had left behind to die. I wondered if Riddle would ever again be the light-hearted man he had been. He